The opinions expressed on the show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Welcome to In the Garden with Master Gardeners. I am Katrina Kirkaby, your Master Gardener host today. I have to tell you, I'm really, really excited about our show and guest today. Vegetables from the garden often produce an abundance of produce this time of year, and today we will be talking about one of the options for your produce. As many of you know, I'm also a master food preserver. Yes, today's show will be on food preservation. We are very fortunate to have with us today Ernest Miller. Ernest Miller is a chef, historian, educator, consultant, and speaker who teaches classes in museums, schools, kitchens throughout Southern California. He has been called the Hulhauser of California food. He is the co-leader of Slow Food Los Angeles, on the Speakers Bureau of the Culinary Historians of Southern California, formerly lead instructor for the Master Food Preservers of Los Angeles County, and founder of RLM Provisions, LLC, manufacturer of one of the best fermenting kits on the market. Welcome, Ernest. Thank you so much for being at our with us today.
It's my absolute pleasure, and I want to say hi to all the Master Gardeners in Orange County. You know, I went through the Master Gardener program in Los Angeles. My volunteer hours lapsed because I was focusing on other volunteer activities, but I love gardening.
Oh, and I'm so thrilled to have you here today. I know my garden right now is producing so much food, and I am taking it to friends and neighbors and sharing it. But I've also, when I took food preserving, that's one of the reasons why I took it, is because I have such an abundance, and I want to save it for other times of the year when I don't have that particular vegetable. So let me ask you a question. Why food preservation?
Well, food preservation, usually we're referring to methods of preserving food without refrigeration. And usually these are older methods. The home refrigerator actually has only been around since about the 1920s and really didn't become popular in the United States until about World War II. Indeed, there are many areas of the world today where home refrigeration is simply not that common. And so food preservation allows us to preserve food without refrigeration. And so we teach things like canning, pressure canning, freezing, drying, pickling, fermenting, curing, brewing, smoking, charcuterie, cheese making, bread baking, long-term food storage, and emergency food preparedness. A wide gamut of different types of food preservation so that you can save the abundance from your garden or from Southern California's amazing farmers markets and enjoy them year-round.
You know, Ernest, you just mentioned so many things, and I could spend an hour on each one of those. This is going to be really tough because there's going to be so much information that you're giving us today. First, let's talk first. Why is food preservation becoming so popular again?
Well, there's a wide variety of reasons why it's becoming popular again. And I think this is not just a transient fad, but actually a long-term trend. I think one of the primary reasons is because the resurging popularity of gardening itself. You know, the sales of gardening equipment and gardening seeds has, you know, tripled within the last 5 years. And as you yourself have just stated, once you start gardening, you soon find that you have an abundance of food that you can't eat fast enough while it's still fresh. And so, you know, other than giving it away all the time, if you want to save it for yourself, then you have to learn certain food preservation techniques because your refrigerator is simply not going to cut it. In addition, people are, of course, growing their own food or preserving their own food from farmers markets because they know where the food comes from. So they're able to use organic produce if that's what they want. They're able to know what ingredients go into their food, so it's not a bunch of funny chemicals or something they don't understand what's happening in their food. People are also doing it to help preserve the environment, to increase the sustainability. You know, so when we're shipping food all around the world, places are growing the food in environmentally unsound ways. By preserving your own food where you know of its origins, then you can help make the environment more sustainable. And here in California with our drought, obviously this is incredibly important. for not only the environment's health, but our own personal health. Of course, flavor. People are doing this because, you know, the more commercial manufacturers, let's face it, you're making a strawberry jam, you're a commercial manufacturer. The fewer strawberries you can put in there, the more sugar you can put in there, the better. Why? Because strawberries are expensive and sugar's cheap. But if I'm making my strawberry jam, I'm going to use local seasonal strawberries at their peak of flavor, and I'm going to pack it with as many strawberries as I can and as little sugar as possible. Still going to need sugar, but it's going to taste a lot better.
I have to tell our audience, if you haven't had homemade preserved jam, it is incredible. It is just like a whole new world opens up to you. And when you try something that Ernie's made or a food preserver's made, and it's really at the top of the season, it's such a game changer.
Oh, it absolutely is. Like strawberries. You can get strawberries here at the supermarkets year-round. But those strawberries in January, they may look pretty, but they're going to be flavorless and just tart. Now, by the way, that's malic acid. That's the tartness of strawberries. They also contain a lot of vitamin C. I always like to talk about, you know, the health benefits of this. So they're going to be expensive, but if you buy strawberries in season, and we're getting kind of towards the end of strawberry season now, you know, they're going to be less expensive, and they're going to be incredibly flavorful. And then you make strawberry jam, and when you crack that open in January, oh, it's like tasting summer again.
Oh, indeed. Sometimes it's even better than summer again. It just is incredible. You know, maybe we'll run through a few things, and then could we come back and talk a little bit more about the different subjects, to different headers of what we can talk about?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but the only and one other thing I want to say, though, I think why food preservation is coming back, is because of our economy. People are looking to get the most value for their money. We had this major recession that's finally over, but, you know, people still haven't really recovered, and we're not making a lot of money. And in many ways, our economy has transformed so that the rich have been getting richer, the poor have been getting poorer, and the middle class kind of staying the same. Food preservation is one way to get the most bang for your buck. I can put up a jar of beans for about 35 to 40 cents. No way could I buy a jar of beans for less than a dollar, even on sale generally. And again, the same thing with our jams and jellies and pickles and things like that. So it's one way to get the most money, most value for your, you know, money.
Value, you know the quality, you know where it's come from, and then you have the taste.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness, this is all sounding good. What do you see as the future of food preservation?
Well, I like several things. Number one is education. We have to have people going out there and teaching people how to do food preservation. Your grandma probably did food preservation and knows some of it. But did you take that knowledge on?
Not at all.
My mother didn't either. I grew up when my grandmother was babysitting me. I remember the hiss of the pressure canner. Now, she didn't teach me how to pressure can at that time, but I remember that's something, you know, she did while I was being babysat. But my mother never did it. And we've lost this. In fact, many people don't even really know how to cook anymore. And so we need to educate people, teach them how to cook. We need to bring home economics back to the classroom. And home economics, not, oh, let's make some pineapple upside-down cake. Don't get me wrong, I love pineapple upside-down cake. But, you know, not this Betty Crocker figment, but rather solid nutritional advice. Because, you know, we can teach our children how to eat properly now and cook for themselves when they become adults. Or we can let them go on to eat ramen and fast food all the darn time and then pay for it later on when we have to subsidize health care and have lower productivity costs and lower quality of life. So we need to educate the public, and we especially need to educate the public how to do this safely. Some of the stuff Grandma did, even if she taught you, may not be safe. And some of the information on the Internet, well, okay, it's the Internet, right?
You know, Ernie, I'm glad you brought this up. Master Food Preservers of Orange County has classes to the public. And if anybody's interested, they could go to our website at ucanr.org/MFPOC, as in Master Food Preservers Orange County. You could check us out. There's a lot of information on there. I'm going to be giving out that address several times during our show today. But if you just want to just look at it, see what's there, if you're interested in classes, if you we do a lot of classes for the public, and you can come and learn these different techniques. if you just have questions about what you're doing, you can go to that page and look at it. If you have further questions, or if there's a particular question, you can also go to our hotline, which is uccemfp@ucdavis.edu. So that's where you can ask a particular question. And I'm going to throw that out again today, but what we want to do is motivate you to say, I want to try this. And it light up your life a little bit, because there's so much incredible things that can be done with our summer harvest. And there's so many different reasons why. And Ernest just barely started to talk about it, but I just want to throw that in. So I'm sorry to interrupt, Ernest. Keep going.
Oh, no worries. So I think education is, you know, the future of food preservation. Also, community. You know, food is a communal thing. Sure, you can sit at home and, you know, eat one of those frozen meals for one type things. But generally, we share food, and we share the preparation of food, particularly in food preservation. It's a long honored tradition that entire communities, families, villages would get together to preserve food for the off season. In northern Poland, entire villages would get together to put up barrels and barrels of sauerkraut. There's a family that I know of here in Southern California, old Italian family. And you've got the grandmother, you've got the grandchildren, the uncles, the nephews, the nieces, the aunts, the cousins. They get together as a whole family, and they go out to a U-pick tomato farm, where they pick like 1,500 pounds of tomatoes.
Wow.
It's a big family. And then they actually rent a kitchen, and they all work together to can those tomatoes, you know, for the entire family. And there are a lot of other groups that are getting together to do community-oriented events. This is where we share our knowledge. This is where we make connections and friendship. And although you can, you know, stay at home and by yourself can and dehydrate or ferment, doing it with somebody else, you know, family, friend, a neighbor, you know, gossiping as you do it, you know, community can be built through food preservation. And finally, this is important to our culture. You know, there are many ways that we get culture. We get culture through, you know, art, music, science, literature. But there's only one type of culture that we get practically every day, and that's food culture, usually multiple times a day. And the food you eat becomes the person you are, not just metaphorically, but literally. And if you tell me what you eat, I can tell you where you're from. And if all we eat is fast food, industrialized food, we're going to lose that. We're going to lose that connection to our past. If you think about, you know, the major cultures of the world, oftentimes you're going to think about their food. And, you know, what would the French be without cheese and wine? What would the Germans be without sauerkraut, sausage, and beer? The Koreans, the national dish is fermented cabbage, kimchi. El Salvador, you know, pupusas and cartido, you know, fermented dish. And the Italians, what would they be without canned tomatoes?
History through food.
Absolutely. I like to say that my knife is a TARDIS, which is like a Doctor Who reference. The TARDIS is time and relative dimension in space. It's a time machine, but can also go anywhere. And with my knife, I can take you to any region of the world, to any time by doing this. And I think that's really important when you eat food and you tell stories. Not only does the food taste better, it's actually scientifically proven. When you tell stories, food tastes better. But you feed the mind, the body, the soul. And I think that's incredibly important. And food preservation is a way to do that, because many of our food traditions are actually preserved foods.
I'm enthralled. This is exciting. Our traditions are what is it you? There's so many different types of preservation. Do you have a favorite?
Probably fermentation. You know, fermentation is the preservation of food through microbiological action.
This is one of my favorite topics. Could we talk a bit on this?
Oh, absolutely. I love fermentation.
Oh, please. Tell us about fermentation.
So fermentation, again, is the preservation of food through microbiological action. And it's actually one of the earliest sparks for human civilization. And it's incredibly important for nutrition as well. The human body actually has more bacteria than human cells. We're more bacteria than human. And our internal biome, the bacteria that live in our gut, the bacteria that, you know, live in other parts of our bodies plays an incredible important role in our immune system, in our digestive system. And, you know, scientifically, we're finding out a lot more about it. I'm not going to get crazy and make all sorts of radical claims about how it's a miracle weight loss, you know, it's a cancer cure, puts hair back on your head and vigor back in your bed. But we do know that if you don't have a healthy internal biome, for example, say you have to take chemotherapy, say you have to get massive doses of antibiotics that kill off your internal biome, that you become very susceptible to other diseases, that you have a hard time digesting food and getting proper nutrition from that food, that you're going to be very sick. You know, we live in symbiosis with bacteria, and so we need to get the good bacteria. And fermented foods of all sorts is part of that. And as I like to say, you know, fermentation is the foundation for civilization.
And why do you say that?
Well, early man figured out that you can take honey, fruit, and grain, and through fermentation convert it to mead, wine, and beer. And not only is this delicious, but very nutritious. In fact, in certain of our ancient civilizations, you might get one-third to half your calories from fermented beverages.
Really? I did not know that.
Oh, absolutely. Because you'd be drinking it all day long. And, of course, you know, back in the day before there was HBO and Game of Thrones or Netflix and House of Cards and things like that, it's probably the best entertainment going on. And it probably, anthropologists believe, sparked our switch to civilization, because we have to have agriculture if you want to have more of this delicious fermented food. Now, of course, food preservation is a very important part of that, because so you decide to switch over to growing grains to make beer. So you grow the grains. You're very excited. You harvest the grains. You have a great harvest. You throw a harvest party. Everybody's excited. You're making porridge. Perhaps you're baking a primitive bread, a flatbread, and you're going to be making beer. But you don't know how to properly dry the grains. Dehydration, food preservation. The grains go bad. You starve to death. Experiment over. You need to know how to do food preservation of all sorts in order to preserve the harvest. So we switch to agriculture. This is also the start of other aspects of civilization that are incredibly important, such as writing. The earliest writing that we're familiar with is from Sumeria, cuneiform on the clay tablets. And those clay tablets, you know, stored in the desert will last for thousands of years. And we found a lot of them. What were they first writing about? Primarily inventories of stored food, contracts for stored food. And most of these foods were the preserved foods, including beer. The most common symbol in cuneiform writing was the symbol for beer. It was in contracts. They paid salaries with it. And that's what people wanted, was
beer.
And so thus, writing, important to civilization. Also, earliest trade. Nowadays, we trade everything. You know, the Chinese send us a lot of electronics, and we send them a lot of money. But early days, they were trading preserved foods. There was no cold chain. There were no trucking industries. Couldn't, you know, perishable foods could not be traded, but it was preserved foods, including, of course, beer, were being traded. And this is cultural exchange. This is knowledge exchange. And this is how we build civilization. And finally, preserved foods actually provide more calories and are safer than many raw foods. And so we actually create a population boom. You know, once we're able to switch to agriculture and have stored food so that we can get through the lean times, we're going to get more calories, and we're going to have a stronger growth of population with less foodborne illness. I mean, still rough back then. It's not like the modern day where obesity is a major problem. Nevertheless, the development of preserved, particularly fermented foods, which would be some of the earliest preserved foods, you know, gave rise to civilization.
Oh, my goodness, this is great. A couple questions as you were going on there. A lot of people are concerned about preserving food, and they consider it dangerous. And could you help alleviate some of that myth or tell us a little bit about the safety issues and why it is safer than raw foods, and about food, a little bit about foodborne illness along with fermentation?
Oh, absolutely. So foodborne illness, actually, you know, very important topic. Hundreds of thousands of people get foodborne illness every year in the United States, and thousands actually die. Most of this is going to, of course, be between, you know, foods improperly stored at temperatures, foods contaminated by, you know, people with disease, particularly, you know, the cooks and whatnot. So cooks don't cook when you're sick. But, and a lot of times people think, for example, that they don't get a foodborne illness, but if you've gotten the stomach flu, chances are it's actually a foodborne illness, probably norovirus, the most common foodborne illnesses. But what happens is, in food preservation, basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to inhibit the growth of bacteria, molds, and yeast through a wide variety of methods. For example, through dehydration. If there's no water, they can't grow. So dehydrated foods last longer. In the process of canning, we use pasteurization through boiling water or in a pressure canner. And in fermentation, we're basically creating biological warfare. We're encouraging the growth of good bacteria that we like, that are safe and healthy for us, and discouraging or inhibiting the growth of bad bacteria. For example, in the fermentation of alcohol, the yeast that convert the sugar to alcohol increase the alcohol level. Many bacteria cannot survive when the alcohol level gets to a certain level. That's why things like beer are actually safer to drink than, you know, unregulated water. Of course, here in the United States, we have wonderful tap water. I love tap water. And it's big bunch of propaganda and marketing that convinces people to go buy bottled water. I mean, very rarely do you actually need bottled water if you live in the United States. You know, maybe you have well water or there's some problem with your local water department. But in general, you know, we've got safe, delicious tap water. But obviously, wine and beer would be safer. In fact, they would serve it to children, usually at a lower alcohol level. And this is good. In the case of lactofermentation, this is the fermentation of vegetables with salt or a salt water brine. We encourage the growth of lactobacillus, and lactobacillus then creates lactic acid and creates an acid level that inhibits or kills things like salmonella, E. coli, listeria, Clostridium botulinum. As a matter of fact, there's never been a foodborne illness outbreak in the United States traced back to properly lacto-fermented vegetables. Just hadn't happened. Never. Now, there's other things, other lacto-ferments, meats, nut butters, that can be problematic. But for lacto-fermented vegetables, kimchi and sauerkrauts, kosher dill pickles made the traditional way, no foodborne illness in the United States ever traced back to these products.
So for the layperson, what we're talking about is vegetables. Any kind of vegetable that we could lacto-ferment, it's a very safe process to do.
If you do it right.
If you do it right.
Yes.
And it's pretty easy too, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, people are surprised at how easy it is. Once you've learned how to do it, it's very simple. You can ferment practically any vegetable that you can eat raw. You can also ferment some vegetables that you might not eat raw. And there's a few exceptions here and there.
I have one for you, Ernie. My husband, and he's going to die when he hears this, is he was telling me how much he detests sauerkraut. And he said it is horrible. And we're sitting there at the dinner table, and he's just bashing sauerkraut. And the reason why the subject came up is because I was serving sauerkraut. And it was your recipe that I was serving, and he's sitting there eating it. And he ate the whole thing, dished up some more, and he's complaining about sauerkraut. And I said, honey, do you know what you're eating? And he says, I don't know, but it's really good. It was homemade sauerkraut. And when he found out, he was just blown away, because all his life he thought it had to be the yucky stuff that you get at the store, not the stuff you make at home. And now it's a regular part of our diet. And it's easy. It's really easy to make, and it really tastes good. And it's like buying homegrown vegetables versus, you know, weeks old at a grocery store. There's a huge taste difference. And when you do something that you make like that at home, the taste is phenomenal.
Well, thank you for the endorsement of my wonderful sauerkraut recipe.
Oh, it's the best. I mean, that's the only one I use. It's a great recipe. It's just wonderful. And, you know, if people also would like to find out a little bit about you, they can go to RLM Provisions. It's on the Internet. He also has a Facebook page. that is RLM Provisions. And he also has some fermenting kits and whatever. And you can look at his stuff at Etsy, etsy.com, under RLM Provisions. It's a great website, and it's good stuff to see, and you can see what he's doing locally here. Ernest is a local. He's here in L.A. He's down here in Orange County a lot, and he does a lot of shows. He works a lot with libraries and other organizations and puts on product demonstrations. So if that's something you're interested in, please check him out. Also, you can go to our website, and I'm giving it again just in case you didn't have a pen before. It's ucanr.org/MFP, as in Master Food Preserver, OC, as in Orange County. Sorry about the interruption. I just got so excited.
No, absolutely. And I really encourage people, particularly if you're down here in Orange County, to check out the Master Food Preservers of Orange County and take some of their classes. Ask questions on the helpline. They're volunteers who are passionate about this and, can help answer some of your questions.
And it's fun. We do classes for adults. We've done classes for kids, different organizations. And the volunteers, we're all volunteers, and we just want to get the word out. And that's what we like to do, is we like to share, and we like to give out information, and we want everybody to be safe. And it's a fun family thing to do, and it's just all in all a good thing.
And I do want to emphasize that the Master Food Preservers are going to give you the right information so you know what you're doing is safe. Because some of that information that you may have gotten from your grandmother, some of that information that you find on the Internet is not safe. And so you want to go to the authoritative source.
Thank you very much. We are UC, part of the UCCE Cooperative Extension, and we do everything that is approved by the UC. So what you'll be learning is safe preserving practices, be it fermenting, be it canning, be it dehydration. You'll be learning how to do it safely so you can share with your family, your friends, and be safe with yourself.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we talked a bit about fermenting. I just love it. Also, how about some tomato preservation? Tell me about preserving tomatoes, because this time of year, we're all getting all kinds of tomatoes. At least I am. And besides giving to family and friends, what would you recommend to do?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, I'm getting a lot of tomatoes myself. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be having a tomato salad for dinner. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to pick up some mozzarella, some basil,
Just I'm simple. Having the same thing. It's wonderful. Olive oil and some balsamic vinegar. Oh, life is good.
It's one of my favorite things, fresh off the vine.
Oh.
It's delicious. But that's the thing. You get so many of them that there are many different ways to preserve the tomatoes. So, for example, canning is, I think, one of the best ways to preserve the tomatoes. There's also dehydration. You can ferment them. You can freeze them, just wonderful, wonderful ways to do it. I generally recommend canning for a lot of tomatoes, large bulk, and then certainly I always have some dried tomatoes, and then I do some fermentation as well. There's a lot to the tomato. The tomato crop, absolutely amazing. And as a California chef, one of my specialties is California food history. And we have a lot of wonderful history in California with the tomato. A lot of people don't realize it. They don't think of California as a tomato state.
Well, tell us a little bit.
Well, the tomato, of course, originally a New World crop. Comes from South America. A lot of the best crops we have came from South America. The tomato, the potato, corn, and, of course, peppers, chili peppers, bell peppers, New World crops. What happens is, here in California, of course, we have a wonderful climate for growing tomatoes in our Mediterranean climate. But growing tomatoes is very labor-intensive to harvest them. So it becomes difficult, becomes expensive to do. So scientists at UC Davis began to, in the 50s, look at ways to harvest the tomato mechanically, which would obviously save on labor. However, people didn't think they could do it. And it was a major challenge, because not only do you have to breed the tomatoes so they could be mechanically harvested, then you have to build the machine that can actually harvest the tomatoes.
And that was quite complicated back then.
It was, back in the 50s. They really didn't think they could do it, or it would take decades. to actually figure this out. But it didn't. It took a little bit less than a decade. Now, you may think, of course, that the mechanically harvestable tomato, well, that sounds very mechanical and industrial, and it is, but they're actually amazing in flavor.
Ah, and with that, I'm going to just take a moment, and we're going to carry on with that. I just need to make a quick announcement. And following our radio show rules, I need to let everybody know the opinions expressed on the show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show, go to KUCI.org. You are listening to 88.9 FM in Irvine, KUCI. Okay, tell us about the machines and harvesting and where the history of where the tomatoes have come from.
Well, I don't see why the Board of Regents wouldn't like this, because I'm promoting the University of California right here, but okay.
I'm following three sets of rules.
No, I understand. And so the tomatoes are actually harvested when they're perfectly ripe, whereas most of the fresh tomatoes we get in our supermarket are harvested unripe, and then they're gassed in order to get the color, and they're not quite as flavorful as they should be. Mechanically harvested tomatoes are harvested when they're ripe. As a matter of fact, one of the food writers, you know, award-winning food writers for the New York Times, Mr. Mark Bittman, actually came out to one of our tomato fields here in California, and he tasted the tomatoes just before they were harvested, before the machine came through, and he said, wow, these are amazing. These are some of the best tomatoes I've ever tasted. So they taste amazing. And so the UC Davis scientists developed the machines late 50s. Within 7 years, the vast majority of our tomato crops here in California switched over to mechanically harvestable tomatoes. These tomatoes are harvested, you know, peak of ripeness, and then they're processed within hours. So that flavor and that wonderful deliciousness is preserved. A lot of them are made into tomato paste, tomato sauce. As a matter of fact, 99% of the products made with tomatoes, canned here in the United States and or other tomato products, are from California.
Really?
Absolutely. And California produces about one-third of the world's canned tomatoes. And so you think about tomato sauce, pizza sauce, you know, any of your pasta sauces, your crushed tomatoes, your whole tomatoes, your tomato paste, your ketchup. Chances are it came from California. I like to talk about Heinz ketchup, the most popular ketchup in the world. It has the Keystone label as one of their trademarks because they're from the Keystone State, Pennsylvania, originally.
Mm-hmm.
But very famously, their motto is, our tomato ketchup is grown, not made. Well, guess where they're growing it? California. And they're growing it with seeds that are derivatives of the original seeds developed by the scientists at UC Davis. So, you know, canned tomatoes, fantastic California product.
Oh, and I know when we home canned tomatoes, it's just phenomenal. And it's so nice in the wintertime just to be able to pull up a jar of tomatoes that, you know, it tastes so good.
Absolutely. You know, and they're actually more nutritious as well. The canning and cooking process makes the lycopene in the tomatoes, which is a fantastic antioxidant. And you've probably heard about it. People saying, oh, I have lycopene, and they put lycopene in pills and things. Makes it bioavailable to our body. The lycopene is what's one of the things that makes tomatoes red, and certain blood oranges, other blood oranges get their redness from anthocyanins, is a wonderful antioxidant. But in the raw tomato, the tomato that you put in your salad, the tomato that you put on your sandwich, the lycopene is not bioavailable. We don't actually are able to use it in our body. But once you cook the tomato, such as making a tomato sauce or in the canning process, which cooks the tomato, then the lycopene becomes bioavailable. So canned tomato products can actually be more nutritious than the raw.
That's very interesting. I know a lot of people think when you cook, you lose the nutritional value. But what you're actually saying is in this case, when you're canning, you can actually add to it.
Absolutely.
Amazing. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners didn't know that.
Well, one of the things I always say, however, is that I wouldn't recommend living on an entire, you know, diet of just canned food, you know, unless you're like, you know, some Arctic explorer at the South Pole or something. But, you know, eat a variety of foods. Eat the fresh tomatoes. Eat the canned tomatoes. When you eat a variety of foods, then you're more likely to get a nutritional balance.
You know, you also mentioned about fermenting tomatoes. I have never done that.
Well, this can be a little tricky. You see, the tomato, of course, is technically a fruit, a berry. Botanically speaking, it's the Supreme Court which decided that it's a vegetable for purposes of taxation. And it can have a fair amount of sugar. I grow Sun Gold cherry tomatoes.
Oh, I love Sun Gold.
When they're perfectly ripe, they're practically candy.
Yes.
And so when you ferment tomatoes, you run into a problem with your fully ripe tomatoes. Because they have a lot of sugar in them, there is a fair chance that your lactofermentation, where you're trying to create lactic acid, will go off, and instead you'll get another type of fermentation. And when you ferment sugars, you get booze. And, of course,
Tomato booze,
probably not the greatest thing. Although, another preservation method for tomatoes is to do a tomato-infused vodka or something like that.
Oh, so, advanced class, guys. Advanced class.
Yes. But, so you have to be careful. In fact, and you can do things like a fermented ketchup. You can do things like a fermented salsa. But it's a little more specialized. It is a little more advanced. But one thing you can actually do very easily is lacto-ferment green unripe tomatoes. Not your ripe green zebras, but green unripe tomatoes. Because they don't have that sugar content yet. And they stay nice and firm. Whereas, by the way, really ripe tomatoes, when they lacto-ferment, they get soft, which is why it's good to make salsas or ketchup, not to try to ferment them and then have a nice crispy vegetable. So the green tomatoes, and so when you're going through your tomato plants and you want to pair what's happening so that you get bigger tomatoes or something like that, you know, take off those unripe green tomatoes and then lacto-ferment them. And then, of course, you can eat them in a wide variety, you know, fried green tomatoes, fermented, is delicious.
Okay, you got my attention. I've never tried that either. Ernie, got Ernest, question for you. I know a lot of people get confused with this expression. They see pickling and fermenting as the same thing. Could you explain pickling versus fermenting and what similar and differences between the two?
Well, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, fermentation is the preservation of food through microbiological action, but it actually incorporates a wide variety of different styles of fermentation. Of course, the first fermentation I spoke about is an alcoholic fermentation in which we convert sugars into alcohol through yeast, beer, wine, mead. And then early man, of course, would have figured out within a few months that alcohol can also be converted into vinegar. And this is also a fermentation process. All vinegars have to start with alcohol. That's why we have red wine vinegar, white wine vinegar, rice wine vinegar, and then malt vinegar, which is made by malt liquor, a.k.a. beer, except without hops. They actually add hops to beer to keep it from turning into vinegar. So we have a bacteria called Acetobacter. It eats the alcohol, converts that into acetic acid, which is vinegar. Then we have lactofermentation, where we're converting our vegetables like cabbage into sauerkraut or kimchi. And then we ferment dairy products. We make things like kefir, yogurt. Cheese is oftentimes fermented. And then, you know, there are other, you know, slightly less common fermentations. But these are all microbiological action. Pickling is the preservation of food through acid. And the reason it works is that most mold, yeast, and bacteria cannot grow in a very acidic environment. Now, generally, when we do pickling, we're going to be using acetic acid, a.k.a. vinegar. But lactofermentation is also a form of pickling because the lactobacillus creates lactic acid, which acts as the preservative. And there are more uncommon acids. Obviously, we can use citric acid, ascorbic acid, malic acid, tartaric acid. But these tend to be more uncommon.
Gotcha. There's just so much to learn. Again, I want to give everybody our website. I know I'm talking about it a lot, but it's ucanr.org/MFPOC. And if you have any questions specifically, you can go to our helpline, which is uccemfp@ucdavis.edu. Oh, my gosh. Where should we go from here? There's just so many different places we can go. How about dehydration?
Oh, dehydration is Wonderful. I love dehydration.
I love my dehydrator sits on my deck and I don't take it down. I love dehydration. Could you tell, there's a lot of our listeners have never even heard of it. So could you tell us a little bit about what it is? Could you tell us a little bit of history of it? And could you tell us about if we wanted to do it after we heard about it, where do we go next? What do we do?
Okay. Well, first of all, you can always talk to the Master Food Preservers of OC in order to get more information on any of these preservation methods. So that would be first place because you know that's authoritative knowledge. Now, dehydration may actually be the very first preservation method. Because things naturally dry out in the sun, and it would have been a way for early man to preserve his food. In addition, it predates cooking. Anthropologists believe that we may have started cooking our food or putting it over fires in order to dehydrate it quicker. And then we figured out, oh, it's pretty tasty when there's some smoky char on it. Now, a lot of people think dehydration is just about removing the water from the product, but that's not necessarily so. There still can be certain amounts of water in the product. The question is whether that water is available to the molds, yeast, and bacteria to grow, because all molds, yeast, and bacteria require water in order to grow. But in certain ways, when we're dehydrating, the water can be bound up by chemicals, sugar very commonly, and then even though a product is moist, mold, yeast, and bacteria won't grow. A couple of good examples. One is honey. You know, honey obviously has a lot of moisture. You know, most honeys are liquid form. I mean, very thick liquid, but liquid. So why don't they go bad? Honey properly stored will actually last for centuries. They've gone into tombs and open jars where the honey's been, you know, hundreds, even thousands of years old, and the honey's still good.
Wow.
This is because the water's bound up with the sugars in the honey. Same thing happens with raisins. You know, properly dried raisin, which is a grape, is chewy and somewhat moist. I mean, obviously it's not a grape anymore. But why doesn't it go bad? Well, because the sugars in the grape have bound up the water that remains. I mean, you wouldn't want a super crisp, super dry grape, you know, raisin.
Yeah, crunchy.
Yeah, no, you want it nice grape. Big chewy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that actually does exist. That's called freeze drying, but that's another story. And so this is called the water activity level. And a properly dehydrated product is going to have a low water activity level, so low that mold, yeast, and bacteria will not grow. And so when we dehydrate, and that's why we're able to dehydrate fruits to a leathery consistency, like a raisin. Most vegetables we're going to dehydrate to a crisp consistency. And so dehydration is a wonderful way. Not only does it decrease storage space, because we're getting rid of all that water, properly stored dehydrated goods can last for a year, and sometimes even more. But usually you want to eat them within a year for high quality. And it's actually requires no refrigeration, no freezing, so there's no energy. Once you've dehydrated them, there's no energy storage, shelf stable. And then, you know, we don't cook with dehydrated foods as much anymore, but our, you know, ancestors did, and there's a lot of interesting flavors and wonderful things to do. So in particular, dehydrated tomatoes are a fantastic addition to a lot of dishes. I take my dehydrated tomatoes, I chop them up, and I put them on my tomato sauces and soups and stews, and they begin to rehydrate. But when you rehydrate something, it never gets the same texture again. It doesn't become completely fresh. It's always going to be a little bit chewy. And so that gives you some wonderful texture.
Because people don't know what it is, and it tastes so yummy, and it's packed with flavor.
Absolutely. So, you know, you put some chopped up dehydrated tomatoes into your spaghetti sauce, and people are going to eat that and go, wow, where's this intense tomato flavor coming from? Because when you dehydrate, you're concentrating the flavor. You're getting rid of the water and then concentrating the flavor of your dehydrated product.
Just a little punch in that little whatever you're eating. You know what else I also like is when I have a lot too many zucchinis, I dehydrate the zucchinis and put a little bit of vinegar, a little bit of salt or something, and then I have my zucchini chips. And it's a great thing to throw into lunches. You know exactly what it is. There's no chemicals in it. You've made it, and now you have it, and it's just changing up the plentiful zucchinis. Because I don't know about anybody listening, but I know my neighbors and family and friends start rolling up their car windows when they see me coming with zucchinis this time of year. And if you change up what you're doing, it's like a whole new product, and it's really good.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree on the zucchini chip idea. The other thing that I love to do with zucchinis is I like to make them into bread and butter pickles. Now, bread and butter pickles, you know, a spiced vinegar pickle with sugar, mm-hmm. You know, a classic pickle, usually made with cucumber. But zucchini is a fantastic substitute.
Really?
And, you know, so I make zucchini bread and butter pickles, and people who aren't paying close attention, they'll never notice the difference from a cucumber pickle.
Interesting. I have never tried that. That sounds like such a great idea. Oh, my goodness. Keep going. Tell us more.
Well, you know, pickling, of course, is a fantastic way of preserving food. Now, we talk a lot about canning, and we got, you know, wonderful things to can, but, you know, you do need to learn how to do it properly, how to do it safely, particularly when you're working with things like pressure canning. You really got to be careful so that you do it right. It's not difficult, but take a class or go to somebody you know has reliable information.
Here we talk about safety, so this is really, really important. When you go to CAN and when you do these other practices, really before you do, read about it, go to a class, go to our hotline, look stuff up, just be heads up, and you can have an incredible time and just really enjoy yourself.
Absolutely. But one of the things that I really like to do is pickling, which is the preservation of food through acid. You know, we used to eat a heck of a lot more pickles. A lot of people think pickles, well, okay, so that's, you know, cucumber pickles. We put them on sandwiches. We put them on hamburgers. But there's so much more to the world of pickles. You know, your grandmother or great-grandmother used to pickle anything that, you know, stood still long enough. And so I like to pickle all sorts of different vegetables and fruits. You don't have to necessarily know canning. There are an awful lot of recipes for what are known as quick pickles or refrigerator pickles. And so, you know, you're going to put your fruit or your vegetable in a vinegar brine with spices and whatnot, and you stick it in the refrigerator. And because it's a refrigerated product, you can do a lot more experimentation. You can change the recipes. We usually don't recommend changing recipes when you're canning because that could be potentially dangerous. There are ways to do it safely, and you can learn about that. But in general, we don't recommend changing the recipes. But if you're just going to refrigerate it, then the sky's the limit. And so, you know, make some pickled carrot sticks. Make some pickled celery sticks. Use those on your crudité platter. Make giardiniera, Italian garden pickle, with cauliflower and bell pepper and onion and celery and carrots. You know, chop those up. Put those in a sandwich. Use them as a relish. You know, the classic New Orleans muffaletta made with giardiniera. A Chicago roast beef sandwich can't be a Chicago roast beef sandwich unless it has jardinera in it. And pickled fruit, you know, pickled peaches this time of year, pickled plums. You know, there's so many wonderful things, and that sweet, sour, tart makes an excellent garnish, makes an excellent side, adds flavor to a dish, makes it interesting.
Can all these things be made for the refrigerator?
Or are you virtually all of them, yes.
Really? Because what I really want to get through to our listeners is that food preservation can be very, very safe. But when you start with canning and some other things, you really need to be heads up and to be read the directions, follow a proven recipe. Like what you said, refrigeration is something different. You could play with the recipes. But if you're going to do canning, the traditional canning, you need to follow the recipes, and that's my lecture for the day.
I completely concur. I absolutely agree. But that's why, you know, making a refrigerator pickle is a great way for people to start. And once you start going, wow, this is amazing flavor here, then you can start thinking about increasing your production, and then you want to can it. Then learn proper canning, learn proper pressure canning, and go on. Same thing with jams and jellies, by the way. A lot of people are afraid to make jams and jellies because they remember grandma, and it was an all-day process, and huge flats of strawberries, and steam, and stickiness, and, you know. Well, grandma was putting up strawberries for the year, so she was doing a lot of canning. You don't have to can jams and jellies. You can make small batch jams and jellies that you're just going to put in the refrigerator.
You know, if it's just for you and your family.
You know, make one jar, two jars, refrigerate it, and you don't have to go through the canning process. It's a great way to get started. And once you're familiar with making jams and jellies and feel comfortable with the process, then learn canning.
Come to a canning class. You see Master Gardeners put them on here in Orange County all the time. And if it hits you and you'd like to do it, it's a safe place to come and learn how to do it.
But you don't have to do canning in order to make jams and jellies,
yes,
or other sweet preserves. And I actually recommend for beginners to start off small, because if you make a mistake and you've got, you know, a 40-pound flat of strawberries, well, you're going to be very upset. But if you're only using a pound of strawberries and you make a mistake, lesson learned.
Lesson learned. And you know, it's supposed to be fun.
Absolutely.
It's supposed to be fun. And a lot of us take on things that are really big projects. And then if we just decided to take on something smaller and see if we like it first, and then kind of work our way up and learn the intricacies of our kitchen and other recipes and find out if it's really something we like or not before you take a huge step.
Well, you know, I pretty much guarantee if you start making your own homemade pickles and homemade jams and jelly, you're going to like it. and if you're not particularly fond of it, somebody in your family will be begging for that.
I bet so. I know that for a fact. It's wonderful.
Well, and sauerkraut convert, apparently.
Oh, we have a sauerkraut. There's sauerkraut going at my house all the time. And it's like, when is it going to be done? And that's the reason why I asked you to bring some more of your fermenting jars today, is because I want to have more things going at the time. And just kind of, my family's loving it, and it's good for them, and it's just fun. And I actually set them on the mantelpiece, you know, so it doesn't get too hot. It's kind of pretty to look at.
Absolutely.
It's great conversation when people come over.
I put mine on the mantelpiece as well.
Do you really?
Well, because I oftentimes have five or six things going at the same time. Where else am I going to put them?
Exactly.
So, absolutely. And, you know, the funny thing is you can also combine preservation methods. For example, you can ferment sauerkraut, and you can also safely can it. You can ferment sauerkraut, and you can also dehydrate it. And, for example, most of my sauerkraut I keep raw, mm-hmm, but I also can sauerkraut, so I have some shelf-stable stuff. You know, when the big one hits, the earthquake, I will still have sauerkraut. Now, the canning process transforms the flavor and the texture, making it softer, not as crispy, obviously, the cooking process. But, you know, I grew up with the canned sauerkraut, and I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, many times when I'm going to be using my sauerkraut, eating it raw, obviously, but sometimes I'm going to cook it. I'm going to braise it. I'm going to make, you know, braised sausage and sauerkraut, where I'm going to cook the sauerkraut anyway. So the fact that it's already pre-cooked because of the canning process, that's fine. It's perfect for then using as a braise. And then the dehydrated sauerkraut, I usually chop up or even grind to a powder. And then I can add sauerkraut flavor to dishes where I don't want to add wet cabbage. One of my favorite things to do in the fall for Oktoberfest time is to make homemade Chex Mix and then mix it with sauerkraut powder. So now my homemade Chex Mix tastes like sauerkraut. Goes great with homemade beer or any other beer.
Oh, my gosh. There's so much to do, and we're running out of time. Ernest, a couple things I need to tell everybody is that if they're interested, they can look at our website, which is ucanr.org/MFPOC. If they have questions on the, you could write in questions on our helpline, which is uccemfp@ucdavis.edu. If you'd like to find out more about Ernest and what he does, he's on Facebook at RLM Provisions. He also has these wonderful canning jars that I personally use, and you could get those at, you could check them out and look at them at etsy.com. You could also Google him at RLM Provisions LLC. I thank you, Ernest, for being here today. There's just so much we could talk about, and I've learned so much. I really appreciate your time and your energy. And any last words of wisdom?
Go out and eat some fermented food. Whether you make it yourself or not, it's good and good for you.
All righty. Well, thank you for being with us today. I really, really appreciate it. I am Katrina Kirkaby, your UCCE Master Gardener with In the Garden with Master Gardeners. Thank you so much.